So this is the first day of our seven-day silent retreat here at Southern Dharma, a place of great natural wonderment. An environment that makes it easy, or easier, to let go of one's meanderings of the mind and its fabrications, and invites us to be present to the wonderments of the natural world. How could any of our thoughts, any of our dramas or melodramas, any of our issues, past and present, stand up against the beauty that surrounds us? The sound of the creek, the wind, the trees, the rocks, the boulders. And for those of you who don't go to bed at night, the wonder, magical, of the fireflies up the road. So please use the natural environment that we are fortunate to be in this week to calm your minds, to rebalance your priorities, to remind you that there is great natural beauty and ease all around us. We just have to open our eyes, open our ears, and be present, which is quite easy. We don't have to work hard at that. So this is sort of, when you get on the airplane and they kind of announce where the airplane's going, just to make sure that everybody's on the right plane. Let me just give you the title and the content of this retreat so everybody can be sure that they're in the right place before we take off, so to speak. So this is a seven-day retreat entitled Unfettering the Natural Mind, the Path of Clear Seeing. And the description says, since the time of the Buddha, countless teachers have pointed out the innate simplicity and spontaneous wisdom of our true mind. Unfettered by conditioning and emotional reactivity, this mind has the capacity to guide us and support us spontaneously in living an awakened life. Using meditative texts, poems, and songs from the Zen, Chan, and Great Perfection traditions, Fred will guide participants into the world of the Buddha mind and show how to integrate this understanding in all circumstances of daily life. Unencumbered by any philosophical or religious overlay, the natural wisdom and compassion of these lineages of enlightened living will be presented to demonstrate their relevance to our modern life. Okay, so that's the plane. That is the plane we are riding on, and I will do my best to guide, support, prod, etc., all of us, so we can accomplish this wonderful goal that we have set for ourselves. I wanted to begin with something that for some people who maybe come from certain types of backgrounds or certain types of ideas about Buddhism may seem a little over the top, a little emotional, a little interesting, because it is called the cloud banks of nectar, a yearning, supplication, and aspiration to the three roots. And it's by a very interesting 14th century Buddhist teacher in the Tibetan tradition called Rabjan Longchenpa. And Longchenpa is considered you notice that when I talked about Chan, Zen, and great perfection, most people are familiar with Zen, right? And Chan is just the Chinese. Actually, before there was Zen, there was Chan. Chan is actually the original, because what is called Zen came from China to Japan. In China, it was called Chan, and in Zen, it was in China. In Japan, it was called Zen. But actually, the teachings of Chan were said to have been brought to China by an Indian in the 8th century, and his name was Bodhidharma. And he is this is he who sits with us for this week. And if you take a look at him, he looks a little different than the Buddhas, right? You notice above him is the Buddha. And the Buddha is usually presented what? Quite sweet. Calm and peaceful, right? We like a Buddha like that, don't we? But if you look at Bodhidharma, he's a little rough. He's wearing a robe. He's got a, or maybe a blanket wrapped around him. He's bearded, unshaven. And if you look at him, his eyes are just piercing. He's looking straight ahead. He looks right through you. And he doesn't have a sweet expression. He's got a very stern expression. We need sweet Buddhas, and we need grumpy Bodhidharmas in our practice. Sometimes we need sweet encouragement, and sometimes we need a good kick in the pants, right? So we have them both here. But it's interesting that Bodhidharma, who's Indian, brought these teachings that point directly to the mind, to China. And the founder of this tradition that I'm referring to now, in the Tibetan tradition, was brought to Tibet around more or less the same historical period as Bodhidharma by an Indian by the name of Padmasambhava. And it's interesting that both of them brought these fundamental teachings that point directly to the mind and the innate spontaneous capacity of all beings to awaken to this. There's a lot of similarities in teachings and realization and practice between the Chan or Zen and great perfection, or it's called in Tibetan Zopa Chenpo, or Dzogchen. The great perfection means what? That everything, inherently, just as it is perfect. Nothing is lacking. Nothing is missing. Nothing is deficient at all. This is the great perfection. It is a perfection that does not stand apart from imperfection. Perfection, imperfection, is creations of a dualistic mind. But the mind that sees clearly, that is unfettered by delusive thinking, will see the innate perfection of everything. So Longchenpa was a 14th century, considered one of the great minds, great writers, great realization masters. Of this Dzogchen, great perfection tradition. So you might be surprised that this, because if you read his writings, anybody who kind of doesn't get the Heart Sutra, you know, that we chanted this morning, try Longchenpa. He really is quite profound and deep. And yet he writes this yearning supplication and aspiration. And I want to begin our retreat with it. Again, it's like this morning. We invoked the names of the Buddhas, didn't we, the Bodhisattvas? And we bow to them. We touch the earth out of respect to them. Now, what's that about? One may think that's about that there are these entities, these permanent entities, celestial mind beings that exist somewhere outside of ourselves, and we are, and we're asking for their help and support. Separation. Actually, in this tradition, what we're understanding is we are acknowledging these capacities of our own mind to be awake, to engage in compassionate action, to cultivate the great wisdom and seeing, to have our activity always be enlightened, etc. So that is what we are actually touching. In this supplication, it is very important. Many people have a practice that doesn't touch them emotionally. But practice should have an emotional quality to it. The same way if you're in relationship with somebody, a love relationship with somebody, you might want it to be more than platonic. You know what I mean? You might want it to have some heart, some juice. Right. And we don't want our relationship with this past to be platonic. We want it to have heart, emotion, juice. And this supplication is really not the supplication of an individual to other entities. It is the supplication of this of a self. Of someone who has lived their whole life identified as a self, as a me, as an I, with all our stories, with all our dramas, with all our issues, with all our loves and hates and hurts and resentments and fears and angers. You know what I'm talking about? That drama of self that human beings identify themselves as and with. That's what's yearning to come out of that. And so he is really asking for those other energies of the mind that all of us have to come forth. Because the ego, the self, will never solve its problem. How many people have tried to solve their self's problem for their whole life? It doesn't work. You know why? Because the self is the cause of your problem. In the same way, people try to think their way, figure it out, right? Now, why can't you ever get to the final figuring out? Because it's thought and figuring out that's created the problem. So we need to come out of that. So let me read Longchenpa's supplication. He says, "Victorious ones and your children in the 10 directions, all assemblies and of Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, which are various classifications, and everyone who practices the Dharma, I supplicate you respectfully, regard me with compassion and grant your blessings. Teachers of the three lineages," and he goes on to protectors and rishis and everybody, "lovingly bestow your blessings on this supplicating child." I mean, he's a great man. He calls himself a supplicating. It's beautiful. He says, "A poor wretch like me has been tormented by unbearable karma and the three poisons for so long. Stretch out your hands with great love and compassion and guide me this very moment. Although my nature is primordially enlightened," so this is not the usual type of prayer. "Although my nature is primordially enlightened, because of ignorance and confusion, I have wandered throughout existence. I am desolate in this dreamlike samsara. Samsara is just the world of birth and death, the world of endlessly becoming and ending, becoming and ending. Please be my refuge and protect me. Please rescue me and countless sentient beings from the endless ocean of samsara so difficult to cross. Take us across the sea of suffering in the unsurpassable boat of wisdom. The manifestations of long ingrained habitual tendencies and dualistic graspings to deluded experiences are more imposing than Mount Sumeru. Mount Sumeru is mythologically the center of the world, the biggest mountain there is. What a great line. The manifestations of long ingrained habitual tendencies and dualistic graspings to deluded experiences, right? Please demolish them this very moment with the wisdom of supreme liberation. The darkness of ignorance, such a dense obscuration, has lasted so long. It is hard to fathom, and its end is impossible to see. With your wisdom, light rays, please clear away the immense veil which obscures the luminous essence. All that I do is but the cause of afflictions and suffering, letting my mind turn completely away from the futile concerns of this world. Please make me spend day and night in Dharma practice. Incorrect thinking is like overlapping waves. Various conceptualizations chase after the five sense objects. Please pacify the eight collections, the tendencies, the all ground with Dharma wisdom. Conceptual tendencies, the afflicted mind of the desire realm, and habitual tendencies connected with the samsaric, the worldly mind. Please purify them all. Having turned away from the pursuit of solitary peace, the inferior attitude of practicing solely for the benefit of myself, let me enter the path of the supreme teachings and enable me to act vastly for the benefit of others. Completely purifying the karma, the poisons, the tendencies of all beings who are on mistaken paths. Please help everyone without exception to journey together to the liberated citadel of the wish-fulfilling mind essence. We have remained so long without beginning or end in the ocean of obscurations, murky with emotions, with no chance for emancipation by ourselves. Please liberate us with your great compassion from the strong and intense emotions so hard to endure, from the pain of existence with so much suffering, and from the level of carelessness, dependency, and laziness. Please fully liberate us this very day. Everybody with me? 1300s, and yet today, right? That should give us comfort. You know, because many of us think, I'm really screwed up, and this is really a screwed up time. So when we read this, it's good to know that people have always been screwed up. Even in idyllic Shangri-La, Tibet, where this was written, please remember, he wrote this there. So that gives you a sense that we are not alone in where we are and where we yearn to be. May we fully realize that all futile phenomena are impermanent, unstable, a magical enticement for the mind. Please enable us to spend day and night continuously with sincere renunciation and weariness. This is the weariness of these futile activities, weary of them. Having attained awareness, super knowledge, and samadhi in the delightful seclusion of sacred mountain dwellings, here we are, please enable us to arrive within this very lifetime at the celestial realm of great bliss, the spontaneous accomplishments of the two benefits, benefiting self, benefiting other. Exerting ourselves in practice, alone and with perseverance, may we not drift toward the concerns of this life for an instant. Perfecting the wisdoms in the footsteps of our forefathers and our foremothers, may we always please our spiritual master. Free from the flaws of broken vows, and unmistakably realizing the meaning of the view, meditation, action, and result, without wavering from the luminous state day or night, may we accomplish the twofold benefit for self and others. Perfecting development and completion in the meditation, the purity of what appears and exists, let the ocean of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas gather like cloud banks with all their wisdoms and descend upon us like rain. May we accomplish all the great activities. With pure perception and devotion arising without bias, with uninterrupted love and compassion, and with experience and realization, the virtues of the view and meditation blazing forth, may we impartially act for the welfare of all beings. What a beautiful line. So that's what this is about. With pure perception and devotion arising without bias, with uninterrupted love and compassion, and with experience and realization, the virtues of correct view and meditation blazing forth, may we impartially act for the welfare of all beings. And then the final line, through this, our perfect devotion and merit, may all beings be fully liberated together, without exception, and journey together within this very lifetime to the Buddha's realm of spontaneously present great bliss. So that is an example of a prayer. But it's a very wonderful prayer. And as we see, it is a prayer that contains within it much teaching. One could just study and practice this prayer and be liberated. Forgive me, I'm sort of getting over a cold, so I'm a little challenged in the voice. Any questions about that? Yeah. So again, in these 7 days, I am going to be sharing with you a series of teachings, most of them short. They're called pith teachings. They're not long, elaborated teachings. They're not teachings that have extensive unfoldings. They are what call pith teachings. They're very short and they're direct, and they are really meditation texts. They're the kind of text that meditators would take into retreat with them when they were going on a long retreat for 6 months or a year or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or whatever. And these were usually the written down teachings of a great meditation master may have written out of his own experience or may have written for his own students to guide them. Remember, there was a time when books were not easily accessible. You just didn't go into a bookstore and you just didn't go to Amazon and order whatever you want. It wasn't like that. Books were rare, and they were printed, they were written out and in woodblocks, So they were, the process of having books was not easy. And so oftentimes, while in the monasteries, they could be like libraries, you know, like many books. Most meditators, if you went into their dwelling place, would have, you know, maybe a stack of books like this. You know, some basic teachings in Buddhism, some basic sutras, and then some very, these short meditative texts that they would be practicing until they reached realization. So I have a bunch of these that I'll be sharing for with you. They will instruct us in what to do with our mind. I'm going to begin with a text called Naturally Liberating Whatever You Meet. Okay. Now this is already giving you a flavor of what these teachings are about. Because usually when we're journeying in our life, we are cautious, aren't we? We're vigilant. There are some things we want to meet, and there are some things we don't want to meet. There are many things we want to avoid, if possible, right? And so most of us in our journey in life, we are open over here, but very defensive over there, right? Whether it's people, situations, circumstance, we want certain things to happen to us and the people we love or the world, and we want other things not. And so our life is always in the world of attachment or avoidance. Always in the world of wanting this and not wanting that. Everybody knows what I'm talking about. And even in our spiritual practice, there are all kinds of things that we see as obstacles, right? Anybody here have an obstacle to their spiritual life? Or think they have an obstacle to things that are getting in the way of their enlightenment and their open-heartedness and their capacity to be compassionate, right? Probably all kinds of people and situations are just getting in the way of us. So we should pay attention. Naturally liberating whatever you meet. How does that sound? And it says naturally. Many of us think our spiritual work is hard work. Right? We even talk that way. You know, I'm working on it. I'm working on it. Right? We love to work, don't we? We love to have a job and a task, and something to do, and something we can say we're doing good at. Many people love to say they're not doing good at it, you know, depending on our conditioning. Naturally liberating whatever you meet. This path in the Great Perfection tradition that we're going to be reading from is often called the breakthrough path. And it is often said that this is the path for lazy people. Isn't that nice? That the great masters, in their great kindness, knew there were people like us. There is a path in the Great Perfection tradition that is called the, it's like the Great Leap Path or something like that. And that's that takes a lot of work. No, I have it backwards. I'm getting my Tibetan mixed up. Okay. We are on the Great Leap Path. This is the lazy one. Take this one big leap. The breakthrough path is, you know, like a lot of work, you know, breaking through. And you got to, you know, get out your chisel and you got to get out your hammer and you got to break through. This is just jump over it. So this is the lazy person's path. So for those of you who perceive yourself as lazy, please pay attention. This is the teachings for you. And this is written by a man who I'm not familiar with, named Kempo Gangsar, who was a 20th century scholar and a great practitioner. He says, so this is instructions to guide you on the profound path. A worthy student is one who aspires to practice the profoundest of the profound and secret teachings of Dharma. The essential law of instructions on the nature of the realization of the effortless ati. Ati is a Sanskrit word in this Nyingma tradition, this ancient one tradition within Tibetan Buddhism. There are seven kind of paths, seven jhanas, of which ati is the highest. So for those of you who are both lazy and also sort of elitist, you know, you like to know that you're, this should really make you happy to know that we are practicing the highest path, but it's a lazy person's path. To meet the needs of such a student, the following 3 points should be taught: the preliminary steps of mind training, the main part of the practice, and the subsequent application, combining the profound advice into key points. Now, this is important, and I'm going to spend a little time today on our first day, even though most of this retreat will be involved in meditative practice, which has to do directly with our minds. It's important to understand that there is a setting that needs to be contemplated, and that in all the Buddhist traditions, oftentimes with Zen, people read these little anecdotes, these mundos and koans of the masters, and one thinks all they did is just meditate and say kind of paradoxical things to one another. But the truth is, all the Zen teachers were deeply steeped in Buddhism. And there was a developmental path in Chinese Buddhism where often people would enter the Dharma stream in their adolescence, would go through years of study of the philosophical, psychological, ritual and all that aspects of Buddhism. And then some would, because they had real spiritual aspiration, would want to head off into a meditative path for realization, and they would go to a Zen teacher. And it was the same way within Tibetan Buddhism. Very complete the teachings at all levels of Buddhist philosophy and psychology and ritual and arts and music and poetry and the whole deal that monks and nuns would study. And then for those who had aspiration beyond just being a good Buddhist monk or nun, then they would go off and enter meditative training. So this is what we're talking about here. But it's important again that, because there's a variation of people here, that at least we spend a little time at the beginning talking about these preliminaries. The first of these two parts, the preliminaries, the general preliminaries and the special preliminaries, which represent the unique qualities of this particular path. First, the general preliminaries. First of all, you should practice the following steps according to the general teaching. One, taking refuge, which is the difference between this path and an incorrect path. Now again, as I say, this is a pith teaching, so that's all he says. He doesn't explain anything. The idea is that you'll either get teachings from your teacher, or you'll know about this, or anyhow. So he, all he says is taking refuge. Those of you who remember our teaching this morning, in our chanting service, we recited three refuges: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Because if we are walking a spiritual path, it has to have some substance. Right? It has to have some coherency. And it has to have these attributes that are involved in what are called the three refuges. And quite simply, the refuge of the Buddha means there has to be this tradition of enlightened masters and teachers, Buddhas, so that the, and when we're talking about enlightenment, we're not just talking about an esoteric, metaphysical, mystical state, but we're talking about an awakened way of living, right? And it's not awakened way of living that someone has mastered because they've read the books and they talk the talk. It is somebody who has realized it down to their bones. So this capacity to have a tradition that is steeped in realization, living realization, and that is present to this time is important, or else it just becomes a kind of a philosophical or more intellectual kind of endeavor. And the oftentimes you find that a lot in spiritual or religious traditions where it's sort of like we're just kind of mimicking the great ones. But there's a certain kind of sort of understanding, you know, we can't really be like them, right? You know, fallen people like us. All we can do is pray to them, be devoted to them, do our best to follow, you know, what they taught, but, you know, we know fallen people like ourselves, it's a struggle. That's not Buddhism. Buddhism says, the Buddha said, all the masters said, this teaching says, all of us have this capacity to be Buddhas, to be fully awakened, and to manifest in our daily life all the qualities that we recited this morning when we recited the qualities of the Buddha. All of us have the capacity of understanding the Heart Sutra and verses on the faith mind. Please understand that. Refuge is important. Buddha, Dharma is to have a coherent body of teaching and practice. Time-tested. The Buddhist tradition has these teachings and these practices that we'll be doing are thousands of years old. They have been replicated by human beings just like ourselves for thousands of years in all different kinds of circumstances, all different kinds of historical situations, men, women, rich, poor. That is important to know, that I'm not just getting something, you know, that Fred made up. Right? I've discovered the truth. There are people like that. This is a transmission of teachings and practices that have been transmitted continually for hundreds and thousands of years. Is that clear? That's Dharma. Dharma explains clearly our situation, our minds, how we got here, and clearly shows us the path of freedom and liberation, shows us how to live a good life. And finally, the third is Sangha. Sangha is community. We are not alone. There are other people on this path who share the same aspirations, the same value, and they are like family to us. Hopefully not a dysfunctional family. Hopefully the Sangha is a functional family. So we have relationships in our Sangha family where there is really harmony and love and support. So taking refuge is the first. The second is arousing bodhicitta, which raises you above the inferior paths. Now here, what he's referring to is in Buddhism, and the people of this path love to rail against the people of that path. They never clearly identified who they are. But it really says, most people enter a spiritual path, because of one degree or another, they are suffering. They are unhappy. Or even if they're happy, they're happy in a way that they know there's more to life than this. So we enter a spiritual path because we are looking for something more in life. So we begin at a place that is very personal. But in the Mahayana tradition, the great path of Buddhism, that is considered an inferior aspiration. The true aspiration is what they call, here he's calling bodhicitta. It's the mind that is seeking awakening to benefit others. So he says it is important that we arouse bodhicitta. It may not be natural to us, right? Because what is most apparent to us is what? Our own difficulty, our own situation. So that often is more immediate. But what these teachings on bodhicitta, and again, all he says is arouse bodhicitta again. There are lots and lots of teachings about how to do that. And he's just figuring people know that. It has to be aroused. It is aroused by looking around. Oftentimes when we suffer, or in difficulty, it is hard for us to see beyond our own current situation. And we are most concerned about ourselves. That is the truth. But if we opened our eyes, and if we looked around, we can't help but notice that our suffering, whatever it is, emotional, interpersonal, physical, financial, you know, whatever it is that we may be suffering, we can't help but notice that we are not the only ones. And that there are millions, if not billions, of human beings in the same situation that we are, right? And that even within our own circle of loved ones, family, friends, colleagues, we can't help but notice that many of them suffer, have suffered, will suffer in the same ways that we do or we have, is, you know. And so we, when looking around and noticing that, one can help if one opens one heart to the suffering of others, which is equal to our own, to only, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I guess what, being on a, I don't know, in some situation, the ship is going down or the house is on fire or something, right? And all I think about is what? Getting myself out, right? I don't give a damn about all the others who may be caught, right? My thought is just, let me get out of here as quick as I can. Right? That's all that's. The person who doesn't think that way, but feels some sort of identification or connection to others, will see that everyone else is in the same situation. Who can I help get out to? So that is arousing bodhicitta. And then he says, performing the meditation and recitation of Vajrasattva, which purifies the misdeeds, obscurations, and adverse conditions that prevent the essence of refuge and bodhicitta from dawning in your being. Now here is, when he talks about the recitation of Vajrasattva, he's talking about a very specific practice with visualizations and Buddhas. But what this really means for those of us here is there has to be an acknowledgement that in our life, past and present, we have often acted unskillfully. Many of our actions have led to unhappiness or suffering or harm to ourselves or to others. There has to be an acknowledgement of that, because if we don't acknowledge that, all those types of actions of our body, of our speech, and most importantly of our mind, have left kind of an indelible mark on our minds. And that mark, that stain, many of that you may call those your issues. I still have issues from my childhood, or I still have issues with my mother, my father, my sister, my brother, my first husband, my second wife, my fourth, whatever, right? They have left indelible stains on our consciousness. And they need to be cleansed. They need to be purified. We purify them through understanding and compassion. So this process, because we want to be free. And we certainly want to be free of these types of emotional and mental formations or activities, habit energies, whatever, within our mind, that are still are heavily, heavily contaminated with a strong dose of affliction. We have to understand that, because he says it's because they prevent the essence of refuge and bodhicitta from dawning in your being. So it's sort of like, with refuge, with entering a spiritual path, with arousing bodhicitta and all these wonderful things, we are pouring this wonderful nectar that has this great transformative power into this bowl that is filthy. So there has to be some cleaning of the bowl. Okay. For those of you who love guilt, or love getting down on yourself, and love going, oh, this is great. I can really now spend this week just enumerating all my shortcomings, all the people I've hurt, and this is not that. The acknowledgement of wrongdoing, the acknowledgement of acting unskillfully, should always be done with an understanding that we did it. Why? Because we didn't know better, did we? Because we were ignorant. We thought we were doing good, we thought we were, and yet, look what our actions caused. And so, as I said, there has to be understanding, causes and conditions that created it, and there has to be compassion. Is that clear? So this is, for those of you who come from a tradition where of guilt or self-flagellation or just looking for excuses to get down on yourself, you can't do that here. That's not what this is. This is a path of understanding. And we will understand during this week deeply the real cause of why we act unskillfully. And then he says, offering the mandala, which is the method for gathering the accumulations, the harmonious conditions. Again, this is another specific practice. But what this really means is generosity. And we have to break out of when you offer the mandala, you offer everything. You offer all, everything you have, all your possessions, all your treasures, all your favorite things, even your body, and then you go on and offer everything else in the world to this spiritual path. The life of ego, or the life of self, is a petty life, isn't it? it's a very constricted life. It always is, you know, counting, checking, right? Holding on, parsing things out very carefully, always making sure there's enough for me. Of course, the me never thinks it has enough. So it's, there's no way out of that one. So this is different. This is generosity. Everything I have, I want to use for the benefit of others. That's why I have it. It's the total opposite of that constricted, narrow view of the self. So that's what it means to offer the mandala, to have a totally generous spirit, and understanding in a quite trite way that when we are generous, when we do a generous act, we are happy. It creates happiness within us. And when we, parse it out, even the giving doesn't really give us happiness. Self has robbed us of the joy of generosity. And the final is performing the Guru Yoga, the root of blessings and the means by which the special qualities of experience and realization quickly arise in your being. In this tradition, but I think in all the meditative traditions, seeking a true experience of awakening, the being, the person who transmits that to us is our teacher. Guru just means teacher. Obviously, we understand that when we have a deep connection with our teacher, whatever it is, we tend to be what? Better students. Right? So, traditionally, in this tradition, it is felt that when one has this deep connection to the teacher, and really has a deep connection to the mind and the heart of the teacher, and takes the teacher as the model for one's realization, that makes the path much more easily walked. Because in our teachers, we see another human being, just like us, and when we are able to be with our teachers, observe our teachers, we see they are human beings just like us. They have eyes, they have ears. We see every now and then they go to the bathroom. We see them eat. Every now and then they get sick. We see, oh, they're human beings just like us. They were born from a mother, right? They grew, they have children. So we realize, oh, they're human beings just like me. And yet, obviously, they have done something in their life different that has brought them to this place of realization and transformation. Oh, if they did it, I can do it. Oh, So the teacher is a living example of the possibility that each of us have for transformation. But more than that, the teacher is a guide. The teacher, having walked the path themselves, knows about the path. Because they have, he or she has walked it themselves and they know the path intimately, we can have something also that's very important, which is what? Confidence and trust, right? If we're going, if we're going to climb a mountain and we hire a guide, we want to make sure what? That we can trust them. If you start getting up there and things get a little shaky and all of a sudden they're making decisions or saying things and you're going, I don't trust this person. Well, all of a sudden the enjoyment of your mountaineering expedition may change, right? If you can go to all kinds of interesting places that you haven't been, you want to have a guide who knows what they're doing and that you trust them, you have confidence in, right? That makes it easier for you, doesn't it? Makes it easier for us, doesn't it? To have that trust, then it's easy. Oh. God says do this, you do it. You don't have to, should I do it, and why don't I do it, all the usual stuff. So in this tradition, that is considered also a very important part of the preliminary. Any question about these preliminaries? There are also other ones based on the meditations on impermanence. Everything changes, nothing stays the same. Moment to moment, sickness, old age, and death. We do that in the five remembrances this morning. Teachings having to do with cause and effect, how things operate in this world. Teachings about non-self, that everything is made up of parts. Everything is interdependent. Nothing is solid. We see the flowers. We think, oh, flower, like it's a self-existent thing. Right? It looks that way, doesn't it? But the truth is, if we had followed the trajectory of these things, we would have seen what? That before they were a flower, they were what? A bud. And before they were a bud, they were what? Just a plant. Before they were a plant, they were what? A seed or a bulb. What nurtured them? What makes a seed or a bulb? But a prior plant, and a prior plant, and a prior plant. And what nurtures these plants? What are they made of? They're made of the earth. They're made of water. They're made of the sky. They're made of sun. They don't exist themselves as a separate, distinct entity. They are dependent and interdependent and codependent with everything. That is the way everything is, including ourselves. This is a profound understanding of Buddhism. There's great freedom in that. When we, over these days, begin to take us apart in the same way, we will find that we are not the solid entities we think we are. Just the way, flowers, as far as we know, don't think. So they don't think about these things. So because of that, they have no fear, right? Because we can think, and we can analyze, and we can project, we can also know that these flowers, so beautiful and vibrant today, will wilt, won't they, over these coming days. And eventually they will just fall. They will die. And yet these flowers sit here today, so beautiful, and have no fear at all, do they? and we can learn from the flowers. Any questions about these general preliminaries? They are to be reflected on. The next section is called the special preliminaries. Please pay attention. It is an unfailing fact that happiness results from virtuous action and that suffering results from having committed unvirtuous deeds. Therefore, you must first recognize what is virtuous and what is not. In order to do this, you must determine which is most important, your body, speech, or your mind. In order to decide this, you must understand what your body, speech, and mind are. So this is kind of a logical, but please pay attention. We are the mind we have today, which means as you experience your mind, all the thoughts that arise in it, all the feeling states that arise in it, all the memories and et cetera that arise in it, all the perceptions, the stories are all arising because of past actions of body, speech, and mind. Okay. So if you experience your mind as a unending, spacious experience where only the most positive types of emotional states arise, that is because of your activity in the past. If, on the other hand, you experience a mind that often has a lot of conflictual kind of mind states and thoughts and obsessions and various kind of emotional afflictive states, again, that is simply because of the activities of our body, speech, and mind in the past. So he's saying we must understand this. Now he says, your body is your physical body which serves as a support for benefit or harm. Your speech is making sounds and talking. Your mind is that which can think and recollect anything at all, that which feels like or dislike and shows different expressions of joy and sorrow from one moment to the next. This briefly explains body, speech, and mind. Everybody clear? So yeah, this is very, you know, the people write books. He just kind of says, okay. Okay, so this is our physical body. Right? Everybody know what their physical body is. This is the words and the sounds we make as our speech, and our mind is this whole unseeable only to ourselves. We see these thoughts in which there is like and dislike and all the range of emotionality. When you commit a virtuous or unvirtuous, skillful or unskillful action, you must ask yourself, is the body the main thing? Is the speech the primary aspect? Or is the mind most important? Please, everybody, ask yourself that, right? So would everybody acknowledge that basically as a human being, we have bodies, we have speech, and we have minds? Is there anything I left out? No. That's who we are, right? We're physical bodies, the physical that can be seen. We manifest through the words that we speak, and we have this hidden world seen only by ourselves, of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, emotions, etc. Okay? So when you do an action, whether it be positive or negative, please ask yourself, what is the main thing that is causing this action to occur? Is it my body? Is it my speech? Or is it my mind? Some people will reply that is the body, some that is the speech, and some will say that the mind is the primary aspect. Let's take a vote. How many people think that of the three, the body is the cause of it all? Very good. Okay, let's move on. Anybody who thinks that it's the mouth, this vile mouth, and the way it forms words all by itself? Anybody think that it is the organ of speech that is the prime cause of our actions of virtue and non-virtue. Somebody must have given you a cheat sheet or something. Everybody's getting 100 on this one. All right. And so he says, any case, whoever claims that the body or speech is the most important has not really penetrated to the core with their examination. Okay. So please understand again, this is quick, but this is important. And this is very important for this retreat. Because what you will notice that is kind of unique about Buddhism, as opposed to the other isms out there, is that it places most emphasis on what? The mind. That is why this key practice within the Buddhist tradition, spiritual tradition, is meditation. Right? Because meditation deals directly with the mind. So can you see that someone has thought about this and decided, well, there, yeah, we can see the body does all kinds of actions, right? It harms other people, it caresses other people, it eats, it overeats, it does good things, it does bad things, it does harmful things, it does positive things. People speak words of kindness and support, and people speak words that are quite terrible and harmful. People use words to spread confusion and lies and distortions. People use words to spread truth and clarity, right? But if I asked you, is the body doing it all on its own? Is the mouth doing it all on its own? And you would have to say what? No. It is the mind that acts through the words, the organ of speech, that acts through the body, that is most important. So the reason is that unless your mind intends to do so, your body cannot possibly do anything good or bad. Nor can your voice express anything good or evil. Your mind is therefore the primary factor. As it is said, the mind rules over everything like a king. The body is a servant for all actions, skillful or unskillful. For instance, he goes on, when you get angry with somebody, you must examine whether the primary factor is your mind or the other person. Well, that's interesting. We think the reason we're angry, sad, scared, is because of what? Come on. Because of them. Isn't that right? Everybody, let's admit it. Yeah, we think the primary cause of my anger is them. Why do I have issues? Remember that lesson we said, everybody's acknowledged they have issues? Why do we have issues? Because of them, right? If I hadn't been exposed to them or have to be involved in them, I would never have an issue, right? That's the way we think. But if I ask myself, what is the cause of my issue, really? I mean, where is our issue? I mean, for all of you who say you have issues, where are your issues? I mean, where are they physically? They're in our, where? They're in our minds. Is that right? Well, that's interesting. Then why do I spend all my time trying to straighten them out? Figure them out? I mean, what a waste of energy. Where's the problem? Where's the issue? In my mind. Oh. Similarly, when you feel attached to a friend, Examine whether your mind or the friend is the primary factor. So even with positive things. We care for somebody, we like somebody, we want to be around somebody, we enjoy somebody. What is the source of that enjoyment? What is the source of that happiness? What is the source of that attachment? Them? No. How could it be them? Anybody here ever think about somebody in their life that they really used to love and then they didn't love them anymore? Anybody that they liked that they stopped liking and maybe disliked? Right? We say what? Well, they changed. The source of that is our minds. Is that clear? Examining this way, you must acknowledge that although the friend and enemy are the circumstances in which the attachment and the anger arose, the real cause originates in your mind. Thus, it is your mind that is most important. Okay, this is important that on this first day of retreat we understand this. So, as the retreat unfolds and we spend so much time looking into our mind and working with our mind, we understand why we're doing this. You understand? That's why we want to get the bigger picture first before we narrow in. Right? This is why we're having brain surgery. The problem is in the brain. Once you master your mind, neither friend nor enemy will be able to benefit or harm you. If you don't gain control over your mind, then wherever you go and wherever you stay, attachment and anger and all the emotions will automatically well up. Right? Everybody understand that? That is why, for many of us who have worked on ourselves in many ways over the years, we still find that the fundamental emotional responses, reactive responses to people and situations still continue to arise. And many times people get frustrated, disappointed in themselves, right? I've been in so much therapy, or read so many self-help books, or I've been working on myself so long, and still, right, this is why. Why these teachings are so profound. They point us, and yet so important. They point us, that's why they're called heart teachings. They point right to the heart of things. Over these next 7 days, we're going to go right to the heart of things. You must understand that your mind is the root of all joy and sorrow, good and evil, attachment and anger. The great omniscient one, Longchenpa. He's quoting Longchenpa. He's in the 20th century. Remember, Longchenpa wrote the supplication prayer. The great omniscient one, he calls him, Longchenpa has said, and he quotes him, when under the influence of Datura is a plant, you know, that causes hallucinations, Datura. When under the influence of Datura, all the various experiences you have, whatever they may be, are all in fact mistaken images without existence. Likewise, understand that under the influence of a confused mind, all the mistaken experiences of the six classes of beings, whatever they might be, are all empty images, non-existent, yet appearing. Since they appear in your mind and are constructed by your mind, exert yourself in taming this mistaken mind. That's what we're going to be up to over these coming days. That is how it is, he says. that you shouldn't take your understanding from books or stories you've heard from others. Instead, recognize for yourself that appearance is mind, and understand that your mind is the root of all phenomena. Maybe we'll continue, because now this goes into a very profound, but maybe it's good if we just digest what we've looked at so far. So you want to be able during the course of this retreat to watch your mind. Just watch it. Watch it, how it reacts to this and reacts to that. Makes us, you know, so when you're sitting here and you have some physical sensations in your body, watch what your mind will do with it. Right? Watch when you go into the dining room and you see food, and just watch the mind, what it does, what it says. As you go through your day, just watch it. Endlessly spewing forth opinions, likes, dislikes, stories about this, stories about that. Just got an opinion about everything. Just because it has an opinion doesn't mean you have to take that as your opinion. That's been the problem up to now. So please, in this tradition, we use mindfulness as the base. Hopefully, as the day is going on, you are finding your capacity just to be present is deepening, right? So our capacity just to be with whatever we're doing is the practice of mindfulness. When walking, just walk. When looking, just look. When hearing, just hear. When eating, just eat. You know, just very simple mindfulness. Brushing your teeth, just brushing your teeth. Don't be disturbed by thoughts. If you have a thought, just let it go. Don't be upset. Many people spend a life, they love to be upset with themselves. Right? But you know, you're upset are just more thoughts. Right? You have a thought you don't want to have, and then you have more thoughts that tell you you shouldn't be having that thought, but you already have this thought, and now you have other thoughts, and right? Anybody know about that one? Stop doing that nonsense. Just drop it, relax, come back to the breath, come back to whatever you're doing. Okay? So mindfulness is the base, and then cultivate a little concentration. So when we're focusing on the breath, very singularly, but you can concentrate in other ways. You can look at a leaf, or you can look at a pebble, or you can look at a flower, or you can look at the sky, or you can look in many different ways, and just practice concentrating, just keeping the mind very singularly placed on an object. Or you can listen to sounds, or you can sit by the creek and just really use the creek as an object of your meditation and just listen to it. So you can use your organs of sight, you can use your organs of hearing, you can use your organ of sensing, in which you feel the body and the breath, all as a means of developing mindfulness and concentration. Okay? And when that mind of yours begins to do its tricks, watch it. Watch it. Whose mind are you watching? Your own mind. This could be very hard for some people. Just watch your own mind. Don't judge it. Don't evaluate it. Don't see it as good or bad. You're just learning about it. Anybody here want to heal and transform themselves and wake up? Yes, that's why we're here. Well, you got to study the mind first, so you know what you're working with. Is that clear? So mindfulness, some concentration, and just watch, observe your mind. This may not be as easy as it sounds because many of us immediately judge and assess. Bad, good, right, wrong, want, don't want. Try not to do any of that. Watch your mind as if it's not even yours, which it isn't. Because we are now so identified with it, you think it is your mind. So watch it. Very objectively. Isn't it interesting what she's thinking? Isn't it interesting the way he reacts to that? Okay? Are we clear? So have a good day of practice, and we will stop.